The following seminar was recorded at the Worship God West 2014 conference and features Doug Gould. It's entitled Understanding the Mixer.
So at Shure Microphones, where I worked for 7 years, I was the market development manager, which meant talking to end users. It had nothing to do with sales. So anybody who would use microphones, wireless, record, live sound, in-ear monitors, they wanted me to talk to those people. And I was a worship leader in my church, so I spent a lot of my time in that market because it was filled with volunteers who don't do this for a living, and they need help. The guy running the sound or the girl running the sound in your church is probably a soccer mom, a teacher, could be a cop, could be a plumber, never did this for a living. Are most of you tracking with that? Or do we have some full-time tech staff in here? Who's full-time in here doing at their church with any position? What do you do?
Youth pastor.
Youth pastor, okay. But the rest of you are volunteers, right? No? Who's volunteers? Raise your hand. Sam. 90% of the church is that. So I remember one time the president of the church said, why do you spend so much time in the church? You know, there's universities who need help. There's recording studios. There's government, corporate, all kinds of end users. And you're spending all this time in the church. I didn't really have a report for him. I said, well, there's a phone book, Chicago phone book on your desk. Look up theaters. Look up recording studios. Look up, I don't know, schools. Schools had quite a bit, like that many blue pages in the phone book. Now look up churches. It was like that many pages in the yellow pages of churches. I said, really not rocket science. I said, every one of those guys has microphones and they're all being operated by volunteers. So I'm spending most of it. He said, okay, carry on. I hate writing reports. I'd rather just use a phone book, you know. So that lasted for 7 years. I was market development manager, and then that job ended for some reason. They parted ways with me. And Microphonics. So, forget this one. Hello? So, I decided that I would try to find another job at 57 years old that would pay me six figures that would send me to church conferences. That wasn't about to happen. So the Lord said, you've just given up? He says, you know, do missionaries give up when they lose support? Is your mission still to train, equip, and resource the church? And I said, I'd like to do that. He says, then find new support. And I didn't make the first phone call. Audio Technica, which is a competitor to Shure, called me. Then PreSonus called me. Then Aviam called me. And about five or six companies now support my mission to train the church. They pay me, and they pay my expenses. Bob Coughlin doesn't have to pay me a thing. I come here on their dime. So to have secular companies send me to worship conferences, you know that had to come from God. That didn't come from anywhere else. All right, so I'm going to ask another question. How many here would you say that mix sound are mixing more than an hour a week? How many? Raise your hand. That's about it? About an hour a week? 2 hours? All right. How many hours does it take to be good at something? 10,000, right. The quantified hour, 10,000 hours is what we usually use to consider you an expert. PhD, 5 years, 5 to 7 years full-time doing something. That makes you really good at something. So you're doing an hour a week of mixing, 52 weeks a year, 50 to 100, let's say you do two hours a week. That's 100 hours a year, no vacation. It'll take you 100 years to get to 10,000. When we've been there, 10,000 hours, right? So, as volunteers, you don't have any time in to hone your skills at church. So where are you going to get the extra time to put into it? At home? You're volunteers. You're probably full-time dads, moms, and working. So you're not going to be able to go back to night school to learn how to engineer for your church. So what I'm going to do today is give you some fundamental, basic, practical stuff that you'll know what the functions on here do and how to apply them. But the best thing that you guys can do at home is listen to lots of music. Develop your ears. sign up for some frequency identification ear training type courses that you can get really cheaply now. If you have a Mac, there's a program called Quiz Tones, Quizztones. It's $20 on the Mac. I think it's $10 on an iPad. And what it does, if you spend a couple hours a week with it, at the end of 6 or 7 months, you'll be able to identify feedback frequencies. You'll be able to hear a mix and know where it's too light or too heavy, too boosted or attenuated in certain textures. And you'll know how to hear that and then go to the board and assign a control to fix that. But if I just teach you controls without knowing what's in here, it's almost like trying to teach you something in a vacuum. It doesn't apply. Right? So before we start, let's just pray. And pray that the Holy Spirit would be with us and open our hearts and our minds to hear everything that we have to hear this week. Father, would help us in our ministries, to help us to build up our church, to glorify you, to bring your name fame, to amplify your name, to make it louder. Faith comes by hearing. The role of the sound person in the church to me, Lord, is the most critical. And I pray that you'll help them understand the responsibility they have in being there, take it seriously, and learn as much as they can, because they're the gatekeepers of the conduit. Faith comes by hearing. Hearing by the word of God. We give you thanks for this time here this week. Bless them and their families and their travels back home. In Jesus' name, amen. So if you want to get a hold of me, I can't teach everything there is to know about sound in 2 hours today. I can give you a lot that you can start using this Sunday without having to buy anything. But there's going to be questions, and if I can be a resource to you, contact me. Doug@worshipmd.com is my email. I have business cards over there, too. And before I get started, I'd like to do this.
I'd like to hand out some cards to you for you to fill out so I can stay in touch with you. Put your email, your name, what you do at your church, your zip code. You see these prizes over here? At the end of this class, I'm going to give away 2 pair of headphones. At the end of my class, I'm going to give away 2 microphones and a wireless guitar system. Tell your friends who's not here now that they might want to come. Or you can shut up and get a better chance to win.
I also have a Facebook page, which is facebook.com official worship MD. If you post questions on there, you not only will get an answer from me if I know the answer, but other people might chime in and you might get some good responses. It could be general questions. My website's worshipmd.com, but I don't usually use it for much. I post some videos on there that I've done. You might want to watch a video that I just did for PreSonus called How to Mix Your Church. It's 1.5 hours long. But it got 101,000 views already. I can't believe it. There's only 300,000 churches in the country. But somebody must have watched it like 80,000 times. That's the thing I can figure. All right, so understanding how mixers work, your question won't be, what do I do with the sound? Instead, it will be, where is the controller on here that lets me do what I want to do? What's a controller that lets me change a sound that I hear in my head? I don't want knob twiddlers. I don't want somebody up there just twiddling knobs, trying to find the right thing. I want you to know what you're going after first in here, and then try to find it. And nothing more annoying to a worship leader, and if the worship leaders in the room can say amen to this, because it's happened to me, you don't want a sound man who's always doing this. Don't you want him to look up once in a while if you need something? Trying to get his attention. Hey. Throw a shoe at him. That gets his attention. So look up. Sound people in churches, your job as a live sound engineer is basically nothing more than a maintenance mechanic in some ways. You know that something's going to go wrong, and you're going to anticipate what that might be. You're always scanning the horizon, seeing what needs to be turned up, turned down, changed, moved, whatever. But if your head's buried in this thing, It's because of two things. You don't know it. You don't know where the controls are. You got to know where the controls are blind. Because I always want you looking up. Here's a trim. Here's an EQ. Here's faders. Here's subgroups. Here's auxes. Know your mixer. Take the manual home and study it. Find out where those things are. Before I start talking about the mixer, there's a couple important things I need to lay out for you. That a sound man can't make a bad band sound better. We get blamed for being a bad sound guy because the band sounds bad. The band is bad. I can make you louder. I can't make you better. Yeah, I've been to a lot of churches. When you got a great band that's arranged, that's listening to each other, that knows the parts they're supposed to play and when they're supposed to play it, they're not all playing at the same time, that band is easy to mix. The band that's playing all the time because the worship leader didn't take the time to spell out when they wanted them to play and when they didn't want them to play by putting rest in or saying, no, don't play here. Let's take an example. 10,000 Reasons, Matt Redman. I'm going to do it this Sunday. All right? So the band knows it's that song. When are they going to get the charts? Are you going to send them to them? Are you going to send an MP3 to them? Do they already know the song? When are we going to rehearse it? But most of the time, 10 minutes before a service is when we see the chart, and then everybody's on their own. It's a chord and it's a lyric. How about this? On the intro, I want the whole band to play. On the first verse, I want lead vocal and acoustic guitar. Second verse, the keyboard pad comes in with the djembe. And on the chorus, I want the whole band to come back in again. On the third verse, I want the electric guitar to play this. Dit, 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 and then rest. I don't want a full whole note chord. I want the drums set in. And on the fourth verse, I want everybody to lay out except for the bass guitar and the drums and the vocals and the harmonies. Those are kinds of simple arrangements that you can do. It keeps the band paying attention that they're not just supposed to be playing, but listening, finding their part. Now, communicate that to the sound person. One of the most important things on a mixer is called a mute button. Mute buttons are used not just to shut the mics off before the pastor speaks, so you can shut off all the worship team mics. I use them in the service when the music is being performed. Here's a little rule for you to remember. Whenever I have open mics on a stage, just take that example again. Is the drums playing in the first verse? Do you remember what I said? It's guitar and what? Vocal. So no drums, right? How many mics on that drum set? Five. Okay, so I could mute five mics. My system now is going to have less chance of feeding back, and it'll have more gain. Anytime you double the amount of open mics on a stage, they're just sitting there not being used, background vocals, drums, choir mics, the sax player is not playing right now, mute him because your system will get more gain, and the feedback potential is radically reduced. So now the sound man has a roadmap of the song. He goes, oh, the band's playing the intro. Cool, everything's up. First verse, everything's muted except the guitar and the vocal. Second verse, I'm bringing the djembe and the keyboard pad in. Oh, here comes the chorus, full band. Got it? System stays cleaner, and you don't have, ooh, ooh, ooh. Those are simple communication things that fix problems, even if you don't know all the technical stuff. Communicate to the whole team, not just to the musicians. Sound person would really love to know what songs you're doing this weekend. Know the order. Know what's going to happen in the song. Okay? Is that helpful? Relationships, communication, and trust solve more problems than knowing how this stuff works. So if you don't have good relationships with your team, build them. They don't happen in the church. They happen outside of the church. Take the worship leader of your sound guy to Starbucks some week and talk about how we can make things better. Take the guitar player out because he's always too loud, but every time you start talking about how loud he is at the service, you get into a conflict, you get stressed out. That's something that has to happen outside the walls. Those things have to be talked about. They can't be solved technically. If any of you are holding offense here against anybody, drop it here. Go back home with a clean slate and don't take offense. Keep short accounts. Keep short accounts with your team, your friends, your family, and with God. If you do something wrong, confess it right away. Don't let it linger. All right? We're going to start talking tech now. I promise. Everybody know what the gazintas and the gazoutas are? This goes into this. This goes out of that. I might cause a political stir here, but one of the reasons I'm against gay marriage is that in audio, an in can only go to an out. Okay. And an out can only go to an in. You can't have an in to an in or an out to an out. It doesn't work in audio or other places. Sorry. Okay, so this is the back of a digital board, but it also looks like the back of any analog board. How many people here already have digital mixers? Okay, want to just shout out some of the names of the mixers you have? PreSonus, Behringer X32, any Yamahas, any Roland, iLive, Allen & Heath. Okay, good. Okay, so on some of the digital boards, it won't look like that because the stage box will look like that. And then you'll have a Cat5 cable or a fiber optic cable that leads back to your board, which is actually nothing more than a big mouse at that point. This digital board does both. It has analog inputs. So if I was replacing an analog board in a church, I'd simply unplug the old board and plug it into the digital board and be off and running. I'm in a portable church. Everybody know what a snake is? Okay. So in a portable church, I don't have to lay out a snake with this because it's got wireless mixing. I can put it right on the stage. We can plug our instruments and microphones right into it, and then somebody sits out in the audience with an iPad. I don't need a snake. However, let's talk about what these things do. These are mic inputs right here called XLRs. These are line inputs. What are these things? They're called inserts. What do we do with an insert? Huh? Insert. Insert what? Effects. Sometimes, if you just want it on that channel. Typically, we're going to use it for dynamics processors. A compressor, a limiter, a gate, an expander, a de-esser, maybe an EQ. And the way they work is, this is just a standard jack, a guitar jack, a keyboard jack. It could be balanced or unbalanced, doesn't care. This one is a little different. It's called an insert jack. The tip that goes into the insert jack is a tip ring sleeve jack. It has two rings on it. Like a headphone jack, you'd see has two black rings. Could be stereo, or it could be an in and an out. That's how it works. And it breaks out to a send and a return. So if I wanted to put a compressor on the pastor's lapel mic, for instance, maybe he's in this channel, I stick this in here. This goes into the input of the compressor. This goes into the output of the compressor. The mic comes into this, goes into the compressor, comes back in, and back into that channel. That's how those work. Understand? Why would I use this instead of this? If I had a guitar player on the stage, why don't I just take his guitar and plug it into the mixer? If it's close enough, I can do that. But if you're using an instrument cable that's longer than 20 feet, after 20 feet, it tends to lose a lot of high frequency because it's unbalanced. It loses signal, and it's also more prone to pick up noise from things like fluorescent lights. So what we do typically, if the guitar is 30, 40, 50 feet from the stage and my mixer's back here, I want to change that. I want to transform that input to this kind of an output, which is a balanced microphone level. Okay? Now I can make this cable go as far as I want to almost without losing signal or picking up noise. This box is called a direct box. Another name for it is a transformer. It takes high impedance, converts it, or transforms it to low impedance. You ever heard of that before? You using these? These come in two varieties, active and passive. What's the difference? Either a battery or phantom power, right? Phantom power is a switch. We'll talk about that in a minute in your mixer. But this is what we should use for keyboards, guitars, electronic drums, anything that doesn't have a balanced output on it. I want to make it a balance so I can go the distance to the mixer, wherever that might be. active has some advantages over passive. It has power in it, so it's going to give you more gain. It's going to give you a flatter, wider frequency response. They basically sound better. So for really nice guitars, you probably might want to check out, and bass guitars too, you might want to look into active direct boxes. This is a map of a signal path. It's a very simple path. The most fun about being a tech or a musician doing tech is that this is the coolest instrument in the band to play. I get to play everybody. Okay? The weirdest part about it is having to deal with all the talent some of the time. But, again, we go to Starbucks a lot. We talk it out. But the hardest part about being a tech is finding where the problems are, troubleshooting, following the path. Because if something doesn't work, you have to know the path that it's following to go back in the steps to figure it out. So, for instance, let's say the guitar player's direct box wasn't working. You know what I always carry in my back pocket at a sound check? A microphone. So now the guitar is not working. So is it his guitar? Is it the cable? Is it the direct box? Is it the cable coming out of the direct box to the snake? Is it something in the mixer? There's about five or six things you have to check to figure out what's wrong. So let's start with the guitar, right? Take his guitar and plug it right into something like an amplifier. Now that works. Okay, so the cable's good, the guitar's good. Maybe it's the direct box. So I take the direct box off, I put a microphone on the cable that comes out of it, and I check the mic on that cable. Nope, that's good. Gotta be the direct box. Follow me? Have some things in mind, two scenarios. What would I do if this happened this week? I know the routine of the service is always the same, but what if this happened? Do you have a backup plan? So try to create scenarios in your head that you're always going to prepare for something that is unexpected, right? So we have a microphone. This could be a guitar into a direct box as well. Both XLR mic cables plug into this snake. A snake is a box. It takes all the mics and instruments, and then with one multi-core cable, goes all the length to the mixer and then fans out into your various inputs. They're usually numbered. So if it says one on the box, it'll say one over here on the cable. So you know you're plugging it into the right input. If they're not labeled, good luck. Mixer? Everybody knows what the mixer is? If you don't know how to define a mixer, it takes all the elements of whatever is up on that stage, or even near you. It could be a DVD, a computer, playback machines of some sort, CD players. Takes all of those and allows you to optimize their level and their tone and then send it where it needs to go. So you have all the inputs coming in. You can equalize them, add spice to them, add effects to them, change their level, and then you have a variety of destinations that they can go to. They could go to a floor monitor. They could go to a recording device. They can go to the main speakers. They can go to the foyer. They can go to a broadcast suite. You have all those controls right in front of you, and we're going to show you how those controls work today. Sometimes you'll have a graphic equalizer between this and your speakers. What a graphic equalizer is? Anybody know what that does? Who doesn't? Okay. The human ear can hear when it's healthy, which stops at about 8 years old. Can hear from 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz. A hertz is a cycle. So a complete cycle from the time the sound starts, goes up, has a crest, has a trough, and it comes back to the zero line. That's one complete cycle, or a hertz. 20 hertz are the ones that you feel in your butt when you hear a bass guitar in a wooden pew, okay? 20 kilohertz are approaching what a dog hears when you use one of those whistles, okay? That's why, after playing in rock bands for all my life, at 30 years old, I think I stopped hearing above 15 kilohertz. And most of us, even as we're getting older, we're going to start losing more and more of our high frequencies. So what this does is it takes those 20,000 cycles, 20 kilohertz down to 20 hertz, and divides them into what's called third octaves. Third octaves. Octave is C to C. Anybody know what the frequency is of middle C? No, A440 is the A above it. That's A440. You get a good idea of frequency just by playing a piano. This is 261.25 hertz. A440. Interesting thing about frequency is when you go an octave below, it halves. That's 220. 110. 55. You with me so far? Or did I lose you? Come back. What equalizers do, it allows me to assign boost or cuts depending on the room that I'm in so that I can adjust it so for things like so it doesn't feedback. So many churches have monitors on their stage with no EQ between the mixer and the monitor, which means if you don't have an EQ there, this is going to feedback all the time. You've got to be able to have an equalizer so that you can find out what frequencies are going to feedback. How would you do that? Well, have somebody stand in front of the monitor and turn it up with somebody just holding a mic. They don't even have to sing. Do this at sound check. Turn it up and up and up until what happens? Right? You're going to hear that. Which frequency was it that rang? If you don't know that by hearing it, that's what I want you to study frequency identification for. So you know how to identify it. If it's low, like, you know it's a lower frequency. If it's up, up here, if it's more like a dog bark, it's in that range, 250, 500. So you're going to hear something and then go to the EQ and pull that fader down a little bit after you find it. Might take you a while to find it. No, not that one, not that one. Meanwhile, the pastor's mic is screaming. No, there it is. You could do it for both. I ring out mains and monitors. Okay, so what we're going to do here then, we're going to turn it up again. So we turned it up to find the first feedback. Now we're going to turn it up louder. You're going to be at harmonic of that. So if this one rang first, I'm going to find it, pull it out. Now this one's feeding back. I'm going to go up and pull that one out. I'm going to turn it up again. Ooh, I have to pull two down on that one. After you do that three or four times, turning it up each step, I can now pull it back to normal volume, and I know that I've eliminated a great potential for that monitor to feedback. That's called ringing out a monitor. You have to have an EQ on each one to do that. And you do that before the band shows up. Yep. I'm turning up the monitor level. The monitor level. So at each step that I find a feedback frequency and I notch it, I'm going to turn it up again, notch it, turn it up again, notch it, turn it up maybe one more time. Three or four usually does it, and then I can bring the volume back to where it was originally, and all those potential feedback frequencies are going to be gone. Now, little Susie, who's 12, singing her special this week, bows to the monitor.
Forget it, all bets are off. Can't ring that out.
Nope. Could be anywhere. Yep, turn it up. You might be in such a perfect room that you might not even get one. Maybe the speakers are just perfect. And the microphone's in the perfect position to reject all those things coming in. The room is perfect. That doesn't happen very often. Jesus was perfect, you know. He's probably the only one who doesn't need an equalizer. From there it goes. Now, some of the digital mixers have these built in, by the way, so it's not a separate processor. For instance, this one here, there's 14 monitor sends and two mains. So this one basically has 16 of these built into the mixer, one for each monitor and two for the main outputs. So it's something I don't have to buy extra of. Okay. Then from there it goes to your either powered speakers, where the amplifier is in the speaker, or an amplifier and then the loudspeaker. Is there any advantage having a passive loudspeaker with a power amp as opposed to having a loudspeaker where the amp is built into the speaker? And any time that you're running long speaker cables from, I don't know if any of your amplifiers for your church are at front of house and your speakers are back here and you're running speaker cord all that way,
try to change that. Try to bring your amplifiers, your amplifiers from front of house closer to the speakers, and then you'll have a shorter run. The shorter run the speaker cables are, the more robust the signal is going to be. And don't use, you know, skinny little phone cable. Get some good copper, 18, 16 gauge, 14 gauge, not the little zip line that you find like at Home Depot. Okay? Buy good cable. Now, powered loudspeaker, how long is the speaker distance from the amplifier to the speaker if it's in the same box? That long. Right? So it's one advantage. Plus, powered speakers, amplifiers are designed to be matched with those specific components. So you're not guessing how much power do I need for this speaker. Maybe you didn't buy enough. You know what blows up more loudspeakers than anything? Not having enough power. If your speaker is rated for 200 watts, you can run a 400, 500 watt amp into it. If you're trying to get maximum juice out of it with a 50 watt or 100 watt amp, that's when you're going to do damage. So always buy more power than your speakers are rated for. You have what's called headroom then. I don't have to max the amp out. Once you max the amp out, you're starting to clip the sound waves, and clipped sound waves are what kill speakers. All right, so that's what a snake looks like. There are also digital snakes now that some of you are familiar with your digital boards. So instead of having this big, heavy copper with a big box on it, Cat 5 cable or Cat 6 cable, the same thing you use for your Ethernet for your computer, minimum capabilities on that thing, I can put 64 channels minimum on a Cat 5 cable if it's digital. And that's a kind of cable I can buy at Home Depot on a Sunday if my cable breaks. Okay, well, we're going to go look at a typical channel strip. Now, this is a made-up channel strip. This isn't anybody's mixer. It's not a Yamaha. It's not an Allen & Heath. It's not a PreSonus. It's not a Behringer. It's made up. And the reason I'm showing you this is because this terminology will apply to any of your mixers. I want you to understand what the buttons and the faders and the pots do. So whatever mixer you go to, you know, oh, that does that. I'm not teaching gear here. I'm teaching mixers. Are you with me? Because all of you have different stuff. So we're going to start right at the top. We talked about this already. These are the inputs on this channel strip. They're on the strip itself. Some mixers are like that. You plug this stuff right in the top. Some are in the back. Some are in a stage box. I just want you to know, though, that if I have two devices plugged into here, I have a microphone and a line input. Some of them will have a switch so that you can decide which input you want to use. Some are not like that. This one is not like that. So if I have a guitar plugged into the line input and I have a microphone plugged into the mic input, the line is always going to take precedence. So if I want to use the microphone, I got to take the line out. There's not a switch. Okay? All right. What does this button do? It's called Phantom Power Button. Condenser mics, active direct boxes. Do I want to turn that on if the level is up? In other words, let's say I'm sound checking. And before sound check. Does anybody know what a line check is? Who knows what a line check is? Okay. Anybody else not know? You want me to explain it? Okay. Line check is something that happens in half an hour, hour before the sound check happens. It's kind of like a pilot before he takes off. He has a little list of things that he wants to check to make sure the flight's going to go okay. Navigation. Fuel. Coffee. All right, we can go. So even after he checks off all that stuff, sometimes things still happen. So you could do a line check and still have some failure at sound check. I'm not saying you're going to prevent every problem from happening, but it's going to reduce the potential for something happening during sound check that will just stop it cold. So you're going to come in before sound check gets there, and you're going to check the mixer. Every channel works. All the outputs work. The monitors work. The mains work. You're going to check the DVD player, the computer. You're going to put new batteries in the wireless. You're going to retune the drums because the snare drum head hasn't been changed since the Civil War and you're new to the church, so you want to do the drummer a favor and make sure his drums sound good because nobody else is. You want to learn some other skills besides just doing sound and make sure everything works. In fact, you're going to check the lights because if the lights don't work, the sound guy still gets the blame. I don't know if you know that. If the offering is bad, the sound guy gets the blame. We didn't get much money, Doug, this week. The sound was bad. Oh, thanks. Okay. Whatever. So you check everything. Then the sound check comes, and now who's the sound check for? Is it for the band or is it for the sound person? Are you really having sound checks or are you having rehearsals? They're different. Sound check is for the sound man. The sound check goes something like this. I want you to get a talkback mic. If you don't have a talkback mic input on your mixer, get a talkback mic and plug it into a channel and then assign that channel to the monitors that you want to talk to or in the house. Because you don't want to yell at somebody from back here. You sound like you're angry. Johnny, turn your guitar down, man! As opposed to, John, would you please turn your guitar down a little bit? Thank you. You sound like a really sweet guy now, you know? It's like, not a maniac. I'm not even mad at him, but that's what you have to do. Ladies, please stop talking. Here's how a sound check goes. Kick drum. Nobody else, please. Guitar, please. Vocals, don't talk about the wedding right now. I got to hear the kick drum. And he's hitting nice big quarter notes, and you're getting a level on here using what we call the trim. That's the most important knob on your mixer. While he's hitting, I want you to bring the fader up. The fader's right here. You see where it is here? About two-thirds of the way up. That's where I want it. There's going to be a big, bold line there. It says unity or infinity or zero. When it's in that spot, it means it's not boosting or cutting anything. It's coming in with no level affected. It's called unity. So if the fader is there, I can now bring my trim up and look at my meters, and I want my meter to come up about two-thirds of the way up. I don't want to see red when he's hitting his loudest peak. If it just flickers red on an analog board, I'm not worried about it. On a digital board, I'm really worried about it. I want you to be way below that zero line. All right? Next, you're going to mute that channel, and you're going to say snare drum. You're going to do the same thing. Bring the fader up to unity and adjust. Yes. Just the trim knob, yep. And once I get it in the ballpark, I'm not touching my trim again, hopefully. That's why you want to encourage the band to play at full volume. If they're going to just like lay into it a little bit, and you're setting your trim that way, and the first song is some like Wren Collective tune, you're like grabbing that trim so fast because everything is red. So you want to get them to perform that level right at the start. Sing full out. Play guitars full volume. Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what's wrong with that. The trim adjusts the level for wherever that signal is going. He's hearing it in the mains. So if he wants to hear it louder in the mains, he's got a control for the main right here. If he uses the trim, he just turned it up in the monitors. He turned it up in the recording device. He turned it up in the mains. He turned it up in the Sunday school room. So wherever that trim is set is affecting all of your auxes, all of your effect sends, all of your subgroups. That's why there's dedicated controls for each of those destinations for their level. But this is an overall level for everything. That's why you don't want to mix with that. And that's why you want to get them to perform full out from the very start, so you don't have to go back and adjust this. Because now if I put that up, maybe I'm not hearing it enough in the house. I'm turning it up a lot. What if that person already had it a lot in their monitor? Now you're actually cranking it beyond where they wanted it to be. Really loud now. You could hurt somebody. So to me, it's like try to get it as close as you can. The only way you can do that is encourage them to play at a real volume. Optimum level, right. Right. That's another thing, too. I mean, once we optimize the inputs, sometimes I'll go over to my main fader like this, and it's down to minus 20. I want that to be at U, too. Why? Because, again, that's the optimum level. Here's another reason. I don't know if you can see it on this fader. Let me see if I have a better picture of it here. That's not phantom power, by the way. Let me go up to a fader position so you can see the fader better. And I'll come back to this in a second. Okay. Let's see. Looking for a better... Okay, yeah, here we go. Okay, here's a fader. Here's that bold line I'm talking about, two-thirds of the way up. This is a Yamaha fader marked with a U or a zero. Faders are not linear. They're logarithmic. That means the scale changes from here to here. It's not the same from top to bottom. And you can actually see that with numbers on the bottom here. See where 40 is? See where 30 is? See how little a distance that is for 10 dB spread? What's the 10 dB spread here? So if I'm making minor adjustments, I want to be in an area where a minor adjustment is just a small move. If I do a small move down here, I'm going to be way louder, way softer, just by moving it that much. That's why you want your faders, generally speaking, in what's called the sweet spot right here, because there's more room to make gradual adjustments. That makes sense? Okay. Let's go back to here for a minute. Okay. Where were we? All right. Now, we were talking about setting the trims. In conjunction with that is this pad button. What does that do? It's an attenuator. It knocks levels down. So let's say you have a keyboard that's coming into your mixer, and it's red. It's bright red. And I've turned my knob all the way off, and it's still red. That's when you use a pad. You hit the pad, and now it takes that level and drops it down whatever the determined amount is. On this one, it's 20 dB. It could be 10 on yours. It could be 15. It drops that level down another significant amount, and now you have some room to play with the trim again. So the pad is used in conjunction with the trim button, or the trim knob. That makes sense? What's that? Oh, yeah. Yep. Actually, these have just a wider range of preamp gain, so they don't need a pad. They have more sweep in them than most trims do. So, okay, polarity switch. What does that do? Polarity. On this cable, there's a plus and a minus, and there's a ground. Okay? You know anything about phase? Time arrival. If you have two microphones in the same source, if one source gets into this microphone faster than this one, those sources are going to be out of phase with each other. They could be out of phase slightly. They could be out of phase completely. So the top of this waveform is meeting the trough of this waveform at the same time. If that's the case, you don't hear anything. They cancel. If two waveforms are summing, they amplify. So when I'm using a polarity switch, I'm usually using it in situations where the microphones are opposite each other. I've got a top mic on the snare drum, and I've got a bottom mic on the snare drum. Anybody using bottom mics on the snare drum? Why would you do that, do you think? That's where all the high frequencies of a snare are. all that stuff. The metal snares are. So sometimes in recording or live sound, we'll put a mic there to get the high frequencies. The top is the attack of the drum. And then this is a tss, all that sizzle. But a waveform is like this. This is seeing the positive. This one's seeing a negative. So they're out of phase with each other. So I would flip the polarity switch on the bottom mic sometimes. Not all the time, because sometimes they're facing like this and not completely out of phase. So what I want you to do is not do that as a rule. Apply it if it sounds better with it. If it doesn't sound better with it, then leave it off. It will sound fuller if it's better. It'll sound thinner if it's not. Sometimes you get a cable that's wired wrong. So the plus is actually on the minus terminal in the microphone. The cable is just wired wrong. So somebody says, that mic sounds thin. Hit the polarity switch, see if it makes a difference. Sometimes when you have choir mics, 2, 3, 4 spaced out, sometimes they get slightly out of phase. Sometimes applying a polarity switch to one or more makes a difference. That's what that does. You'll see situations like this, too, sometimes with polarity. So here we have two microphones picking up the same signal in phase. This actually is a stronger signal now. The two of them are actually summing and amplifying. These are completely out of phase, so you wouldn't hear anything. You have two mics on a snare drum, and they're canceling each other out. These are slightly out of phase. Where that happens is in situations like this. You got a guitar mic. So direct sound is hitting here. You know how fast sound travels? Rough. In sound, we use a rough. It's 1,000 feet a second, but it's really like 1,100 feet per second, somewhere in there. And then I can subdivide that to a foot a millisecond. So the speed of sound is 1 foot per millisecond in audio applications. So if this is 2 feet from the guitar, how long will it take to get there? 2 milliseconds. Now I have a hard floor here, mahogany, tile. The sound is also hitting this. 2 milliseconds away. The reflection is getting into the mic 2 milliseconds later. So now this is 4 milliseconds. This is 2. They're slightly out of phase. Same thing with this. Do you think any of this vocal mic could be getting into this guitar? Do you think any of the guitar could be getting into the vocal? They're different distances. So sometimes a polarity switch will help in those applications. Sometimes not. Sometimes you just have to shut some things off or baffle them. Or put something that absorbs the direct sound from reflecting into the, like a podium. You might have a podium mic, and you might have a lapel mic on, right? So I've got this lapel mic. It's getting into this microphone very fast, and this is farther away. Or you might just have a podium mic that has a very reflective surface like this. So he's speaking into it, but he's also getting a reflection off of this into the microphone. So polarity switch won't help if it's acoustic comb filtering. It'll only help with electronics when you're using multiple microphones. Okay, let's look at some other things now. High-pass filter. Anybody have those on their mixer? HPF. Looks like a little division sign with a number under it. What does the number mean? It's a frequency. So 80 hertz or 100 is 100 hertz, or it might say 120. I'll give you a little hint how to make your vocals pop out. Apply the high-pass filter to all your vocal mics. Also, turn it on all your guitars. Also, turn it on your snare drums and your cymbals. Also, turn it on all the upper keyboard parts, all the horns and all the string parts. Do not put it on the bass guitar or the kick drum. Those are called fixed high-pass filters. And what they do, the 80 hertz determines a frequency at which it starts to work. High-pass filters mean this. They let the highs pass, and they cut the lows. Another name for a high-pass filter is a low-cut filter. Okay? So I'm cutting the lows. I'm letting the highs pass. What would a low-pass filter do then? It would cut the highs and let the lows pass, right? The best high-pass filters are variable ones, like the one I have here. So if I was to shut this off, hear how nasty that mic sounds now? Your pastor might be talking like this, and he's saying stuff, and nobody can really hear it because it's got so much rumble in it. So if I put the high-pass filter on, let's say it's something like you have, and it's preset at like 100. So you put that in, and now I'm talking like this. So I've cut a lot of that bass frequency out. There still might be some more left in there. So having a variable high-pass filter is even better because I can crank that thing up a little bit more and make my voice even a little bit more intelligible until it gets to the point where it's too thin, and I back it off a little bit. But isn't that more pleasant to listen to than this? Right? That's what a high-pass filter does. And what that will do, it'll get rid of most of your worship platforms are plywood or carpeted. You got a kick drum on there. It's like 3 feet from a mic stand with a metal bass on it. All that stuff's coming up into the mic. I'm getting rid of all that garbage. The other thing you need to know about, we'll talk about this in the mic class, but directional microphones have proximity effect. There's EQ in a microphone. Proximity effect says every time I get closer to this mic, it's going to get more bottom end to it, more bass. If I back it off, I'm going to get less bass. See? It also has high frequency attenuation if you rotate it off axis. So you can do a lot with EQing things by not touching this. Just move the mic. If you've got a hi-hat that's burning your hair off, rotate it off axis a little bit. You know, spend some time moving mics an inch or two rather than trying to get rid of it electronically. Recording engineers will spend hours moving a mic just a little bit. If it doesn't work, they'll get another mic. If that doesn't work, they get another source. That might be harder to do in your church. She's out of tune. Well, it's a pastor's wife. What can I do? Mute her. Every time I mute her, he complains. What? Yes. High pass and low cut are the same. It lets the highs pass, and it cuts the lows. Low pass is a high cut. Yeah. You don't typically have high cuts on your live soundboards, so what you might have is a treble control on the channel strip for that instrument that is called a shelving EQ. Shelving EQs are very similar to a high pass or low pass filter. They determine a point at which it's going to start to work, and then you cut it. So, for instance, if I had a flute, flutes ranges from like 250, 260 hertz up to about 8,400 hertz. This little range of what a human ear can hear, right? So I'd high pass it up to 250, and I'd low pass it after 8,400. Now the microphone is only working on that much of the frequency range. It's not picking up the kick drum, and it's not picking up the hi-hat cymbal. Got it? Okay, I'm feeling a little intimidated right now. You got a brilliant engineer in the room with me here, so I'm not going to point him out. I'm nervous. All right, so this is what typical fixed high-pass filters look like. Little division sign, and the number indicates the frequency at which it rolls off. And everything above that is passing. And that will make your vocals pop out without you having to do a lot else. Start with your high-pass filter before you EQ anything. And if you're going to EQ anything, cut before you boost. We'll talk more about that in a minute. Okay. Here's a typical EQ you might see on most affordable mixers. In fact, really cheap mixers don't even have this. They have what's called a high and a low. And those are how I just described to you, a high pass, not a high pass, but a high shelf and a low shelf. What that means is when I turn this up, this is set at, well, I don't know, I would probably imagine that their low frequency is probably at like 100 hertz, and this is probably something like at 10K. So what do you think happens on your car stereo when you turn up the low? You think you're just turning up 100 hertz? No. You're turning up from 100 down to 20. That's how a shelf works. You're boosting everything at that point down to 20 up. Not very useful, especially since most speakers won't go below 35 hertz. That's why they sound boomy. Same thing on your high. If I turn this up to get more highs, oh yeah, you'll get more highs. You'll get from 10 to 20K boosted. So really the only useful things for these on these kind of mixers is to use them as high pass and low pass filters. Right? You're boosting 10K and what? What is it? What's 10K in your mix? And what's 18K in your mix? Now these kind of EQs are more useful. These are fixed at one frequency. It's like having a radio station, a radio with one station on it. I can't tune it. Sweepable EQs allow you to sweep the frequency like this. So let's say I got this microphone on and I want to boost something. So I'll turn my low mid on. And this is called a peak filter. So this is going to have a center frequency, whatever I choose. Let's say I start with, I don't know, 500. I'm going to make it moderately wide, and I'm going to boost it. Check, one, two, check, check, check. Does that sound good? That's what you would be doing if you're boosting the mid-range on that thing at 1K. Okay? Not very good. How I use a sweepable EQ is I'll boost it. Let me cut this volume down a little bit here. I'm going to boost the gain, and I'm going to sweep the frequency until I hear a really offensive sound. Check, one, two, one, 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 one. That's pretty nasty. Check, one, two. Check, one, two. Check. So I boosted frequencies to exaggerate them to find out where the offensive ones are. I'm going to make them stand out. I'm going to amplify them. I'm going to blow them out of proportion, however you want to look at it. Once I found it, I'm going to cut it, and it makes it sound much more pleasant. That's a little trick. Sweep, crank the gain, sweep, do it a couple times if you can't hear it right away, and once you find the most offensive spot, cut it. I usually do that during a sound check. I'm getting a level and one EQ and moving on. If a sound check is going along and you have to stop and do something, use your talk back mic, communicate to them that you're working on something. Don't let them be confused about what you're doing back there. If it takes longer than a minute, you got to tell them, look, I got to fix this. Give me 1 second. Not, hey, can you give me a second? Can you give me a second? You sound more polite. Anyway, fix it. If you can't fix it, move on. Come back to it later. All right? So on good digital mixers, usually all the frequencies, plus one. This is a 3-band. They'll give you 4 bands of frequencies. Bass, low mid, high mid, and highs that are all sweepable. Every range would be able to be tuned in to is the exact spot that you need to boost or cut something. Know what auxes are? What are auxes? Auxiliaries? What do we use them for? Monitors, effects, recording. Subwoofers. Anybody using an aux-fed sub? Do you know what I mean when I say that? No? Okay. Subwoofers really make things sound warmer. Musicians have an easier time playing with things that have some low-frequency content to it. It's tactile. I can feel it. That's why bass players lean against their cabinet. They can feel it. They can't feel the extent of the waveform that just knocked the pastor's wife's wig off from 50 feet away, but they can feel the vibration of the cabinet right here moving their butt, right? It's just, you play easier. If you don't have a sub in your church, you're doing yourself a disservice because you're probably using little top speakers like this, trying to make them sound great for Israel Houghton type content. It doesn't work. As soon as you add a subwoofer, I can turn these down. I can run the lows a lot hotter than I can the tops. I don't like hung subs, but some applications, that's what you have to do. I mean, you know. No, I wasn't there. No. You know, when you put a sub on the floor, it couples with the floor. You get more output out of it. So, anyway, what an aux-fed sub is, you know, when you're setting up a monitor mix for somebody using your auxes, if I wanted to feed content to a subwoofer, do you think I'd want to put hi-hats and vocals into it? So you're setting up a monitor mix almost like that for an aux-fed sub, only you're putting in low-frequency content to the subwoofer. That's all. I'm putting bass guitar in it. I'm putting kick drum, low tom. I might put the left hand of a piano mic in there. I might put the bottom. Everybody know what a Leslie is? Organ, Hammond organs, spinning horn, rotor on the bottom. I might put the rotor into the subwoofer on the bottom mic, not the top one. But low-frequency stuff would only go into the sub, and you'd keep all the other stuff to the tops. Just makes it cleaner. Okay? So there's two types of auxes, though. There's pre-fade and post-fade. What does that mean? Pre-fade means it's independent of my fader. It's before my fader. So if I'm doing monitors for somebody, if I turn up something in the house, I can guarantee you they don't want that necessarily to be turned up in their monitor. They want a separate level for their monitor as opposed to what I have in the room. Worship leader wants to hear a lot of himself in his monitor. I don't need so much as he wants in my mains. So they're independent. So when you're doing monitors, you want to make sure your pre-fader button is on, not the post. Same thing with recording. If I have a recording device and I'm using auxes to send signals to it, anybody recording right off of their main bus right now? How's it sound? I can guarantee it sounds horrible without even hearing it. Why? Because the mix for your room has got to be different from the recording. Why? The guitar player is so loud. Where do you think his fader is going to be in my little church? Probably pretty far down the scale. How about the drums? They're always louder than anybody. So they're not so much in my reinforcement either. Where are the vocals? Cranked, because I got to hear them in the mains. So if that's a carbon copy of your mix, just look at your faders and that's going to be what your recording sounds like. So you want to use separate aux to feed a recording device. Put on headphones. Everybody should have headphones, not to mix with, but to solve problems, to hear things that are awry, and to set up mixes like a recording mix. Now I can dial in the kick and the snare and the bass and all that stuff to a level that's appropriate for that recording device. That should also be a pre-fader. What I use post-fader auxes for? Effects, that's right. So if the guitar player has a delay on his guitar, I don't want it independent from the guitar. If I pulled the guitar down, I'd still have delay. I want the guitar to track with the delay. I pull it down, delay, reverb, they're both following that source. So if you're sending a signal to a reverb device, a delay device, something like that, a harmonizer, an auto-tune. Anybody using auto-tune on the pastor's wife? Not that bad. Okay. All right. The more auxes you guys have on your mixer, by the way, the more places you can send things. And sometimes auxes won't be called auxes. They'll be called effects like this. These are dedicated post-fader auxes. That's all they are. These might be called monitor. Some very affordable mixers like little, you know, Mackie 1202 or something. It might say monitor and effect. You might have one of each. Not much I can do with one monitor send. That means the whole band has to share one monitor mix. The more auxes I have that are pre-fader, the more independent mixes I can do. This could be a worship leader. This could be the drummer. This could be the background vocals. This could be the keyboard player. Right. You won't be able to EQ each channel separately, but you'd be able to EQ your mix. Because on your board, you have a fat channel for every aux. Right? So. Okay. Are we with me so far? This particular mixer, for instance, 32 channels, has 14 auxes, plus four dedicated effect sounds. So I can do 14 monitor mixes. I don't have to use any of my auxes for a recording device because, as you know, a FireWire to a Mac will do all your recording without using any of your auxes. And you can mix it later. So just one less thing I have to hassle with. All right. So this is a little illustration of how that works and where you'd use them. Post would be for effects. Pre would be for recording, for monitoring, typically. So you have to know your frequencies, okay? Spend some time at home listening to a lot of music. Turn the TV off for a couple hours a day. If you're mixing music, you should be listening to music. I don't want people listening to Sean Hannity then trying to mix on Sunday. All right? Pastor sounds just like Sean Hannity. Yeah, okay, I got it. But listen to all kinds of music, too. Listen to classical, listen to hip-hop, listen to country western, listen to jazz, bluegrass, anything you can get your hands on just to be familiar with it. If you're ever in a situation where some band shows up, you should know something about how that band should sound authentically. Got a jazz trio? You're not going to mix the bass like you would a reggae band. Okay? I got an upright. I don't want it to sound like a Fender Precision. Right? So here's the 20 to 20 we were talking about. And you can see this is just a very simple chart. But none of the instruments, except maybe for a pipe organ, cover the entire range of frequencies that a human ear could hear. All of them are much smaller ranges. So if you know what those ranges are, I can use EQ to cut off those external frequencies that have nothing to do with that sound, which makes the mic work better. It's just working on a much more focused part of the frequency range, what's appropriate for that instrument. You can download charts like this on Google. Some of them are contemporary music charts, which will show kick drum frequencies and electric guitars and all that stuff. Some of them are orchestral. This is a cool little slide. Oh, by the way, all of you can have this PowerPoint if you want it. Just email me, and I'll send you a Dropbox link, and you can have it for review. But this slide you might want to print out and put it right next to your mixer. It just gives you a little bit of an understanding what happens when I boost or cut something in this range. So train your ears. Learn how to identify frequencies. Quiz tones is a thing I told you about. That's pretty cool, but there's other ones out there. David Moulton's golden ears, if you want to really get expensive, you don't have to. Spend some time doing that. That'll go further than anything you could know about just knowing how the board works. Know how music sounds and then know what control to go to change what you hear in your head. Wouldn't it be kind of cool if your friend gave you a demo tape and said, hey, why don't you listen to this because you're a sound guy? And you listen to it and go, yeah, sounds a little heavy at 500 hertz. Oh. Okay, thanks, man. And even if it's not true, you sound cool doing it. So... okay, so subgroups. What do we use subgroups for? To minimize the amount of faders I have to use during a mix. I want to mix on fewer faders, not more. We got 48 inputs. I definitely don't want to mix with 48 faders. I can mix a whole show with two subgroups. Main left and right. Assign the left to the band and assign the right to the vocal. It's all in mono, so it's not stereo that way. That would be like a Beatles record. Okay, but you don't know those guys, so we won't worry about it. So, band and vocal. There's the level of the vocal. I want to bring the band down a bit because they're burying the vocals. Bring the band down a little bit on a subgroup. Drum mics are poster children for subgroups. Kick, snare, two overheads, three rack toms, hi-hat, bottom snare. Maybe get two mics on the kick. You might have 6, 8, 10 mics on a kit. You think you really want to adjust 10 microphones in a song? I want to take all those mics and put them into one or maybe two subgroups for stereo. And then here's all my drums. You can go back and adjust the level if they're not quite right, but I'm controlling it during the program with one. Background vocals, keyboards, guitars, lead vocal. I can even subgroups for effects returns. because now I have like cool delay happening. I don't want to reach up for a little knob. I want to bring that delay in just as he's hitting the last note of the song. Hey, 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 hey. Then bring it back. You're not just there to ride faders or just to look at the mixing board. You're there to like maybe add some spice to the thing. You're not just technical. You can also be creative, but know when to use it, you know? Spice. It's like spice. Anybody knows a chef adds too much spice to the food? It's going to ruin it. So start with fresh ingredients. Ones that aren't sour or rancid. Spice won't fix that. So here's a diagram of subgroups. Channel faders are assigned to control as a group. So when you do that, try to remember one thing. When you're assigning like the kick drum to a subgroup, don't have it go to the subgroup and to the main output. Have it go to the subgroup and then assign the subgroup to the main output. So it flows like channel to sub, sub to main. If you hit them both, you're going to get double the output. You might get some distortion. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the advantages of a digital mixer over an analog. Some of you already know some of the advantages. And again, raise your hand if you're a volunteer in here. All volunteers, pretty much. So you have very limited experience with this stuff. Has anybody here mixed sound professionally before? You have. What are you in this class for, man? Okay. Yeah, come up and help teach. He'll be my mentor. I'll turn him on to you later. But the myths are that they're very expensive, they're very intimidating, they're hard to learn. And that might have been true like in the 90s when a PM1D came out. Very big, expensive board. Anybody a keyboard player in here? You are. You are. Anybody else? I played rock in the 60s and 70s, so as a keyboard player in the 70s, you had to have a truck because you had to have an instrument for every sound that you wanted to produce. I had a Hammond organ with two Leslies, a Rhodes 88, a Wurlitzer, a clavinet, two mini Moogs, a Mellotron, an Arp string machine, two Moog Taurus pedals, and a whole slew of cabinets to play it through, and a van. And no girlfriend, because there was no room for a girlfriend. And then they came out with these things called programmable synthesizers, see, keyboards. You know what these are. One keyboard. Hammond, clavinet, strings, Rhodes, all in one nice portable compact package. So I sold the truck, sold the keyboards, got a Camaro, got a girlfriend. And my back stayed in shape. Well, guess what I love about digital mixers? Especially this one. It has presets. Let me get up to it. Where is it here? Presets. So like a programmable keyboard, let's say you've never EQ'd or compressed a kick drum before, or EQ'd a vocal, or put a compressor on a vocalist, or know how to use a downward expander. You don't know any of that stuff. You don't even know frequency, so you don't know which ones to twiddle. So by going to a channel, let's say it's kick drum, you select the channel, and you hit load button on your digital mixer, and that calls up a library of sounds, just like on a keyboard. And you have a whole library of sounds to choose from. So pick out an appropriate one. It's a kick drum here, so there's probably six kick drums in the library that you can start with. Hip-hop, kick, rock, blues, whatever. Select one. I don't care which one. Hit recall, and that preset goes into that channel. Changes everything. Now you have a starting point. Never had a starting point with an analog mixer. It's almost like having a tutor of audio built into your mixer. Because now you can study it, and you can see, that kind of EQ is very different from a flute. That's just a starting point. It might not be perfect for that application. So now you can start to twiddle a little bit. You don't have to twiddle extremely. Twiddle a little bit. Maybe this sounds great for Louis' bass drum, but for Tommy's, I need a little bit different. So once you tweak them for both of those guys, you can save their own personalized presets in the library. So every time they're playing the next time, you don't have to sound check it again. You go, preset Tommy, preset Louis. And if you think experienced sound guys don't use this, you're crazy. When I do like festivals or battle of the bands, where you have no time to sound check between the two bands, guess what I'm loading in 5 minutes? Presets, just to get going. So it's a time saver. One of the big things besides channel presets is scene recall. How many times have you had somebody change your board from last Sunday because something happened in the church this week? There was a wedding yesterday on Saturday, and my complete mix is gone from last week. I mean, you have an analog mixer. You can do snapshot recall too if you have an iPhone. Just kind of hard to see where the knobs are with that little picture, but you can blow that up. But this doesn't even have to do that. If you save your scenes, you can recall them, and they come back just like the last time. And you can save any part of it or all of it. Maybe you don't want to save the EQs, just the fader settings. So do whatever you want. Another advantage for digital mixers that I think is huge is the recording capability. Get out of here for a minute. Show you something. Now, many digital mixers can record, and they record various different ways. Some of them come with third-party software. I'm not fond of that because it wasn't made for that mixer particularly. So now you have to figure out, how do I get this channel onto that track? You have to patch it. You have to figure out how the inputs are assigned, how the outputs are assigned, and you have to figure it out. This one doesn't. This one comes with an exclusive software called Capture that allows you to, as soon as you launch it, I can just do something like this. Arm all tracks. Beginning of the service, it's armed. As soon as I hit play, everything that's coming in that mixer is assigned to its own track, pre-configured. At the end of it, sorry about that.
Anyone can change my attitude on anything. Comes down to who I'm talking to, spending time with you, and I'm free to set myself again. I get stuck in the trouble I face. You help me find my way through. I'm counting on you.
So that's pretty cool. What's going to give you more hours of practice now? Sunday morning when they're playing? Or any time I want to go to the church and play the tracks back?
You've been listening to a seminar by Doug Gould entitled Understanding the Mixer, recorded at the Worship God West 2014 conference. For more information on Worship God conferences and Sovereign Grace Ministries, please visit our website at www.sovereigngraceministries.org.